From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now, and we're following events in Charlotte, North Carolina, after another night of protests following the police shooting of a black man. Some businesses in Charlotte today are asking their workers to stay home. The governor has declared a state of emergency and has called in the National Guard.
So we'll keep an eye on events in Charlotte. We're also following the fight against ISIS, and a report today in the Washington Post says ISIS is losing support in the largest city it controls. That would be the city of Mosul, Iraq. The Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has pledged to retake the city by the end of the year, which would be a huge blow to the ISIS narrative that the Islamic Caliphate is returning to the Middle East. Loveday Morris is Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Today she's in Erbil, and she joins us on Skype. Loveday, you write about opposition to ISIS growing inside Mosul. What's going on?
Well, for some months now, years, in fact, there's been a growing opposition to ISIS inside Mosul. Obviously, ISIS have had a really strong grip on the city initially, and it's been very difficult for any opposition to form. But there is a growing movement inside the city. There's a group called Kataib al-Mosul who have been doing several campaigns. One of them is most recently a graffiti campaign, part of the group has been doing on buildings around Mosul. They've been spraying the letter M for Mukawama, which means resistance in Arabic.
And how is ISIS responding to that?
We've had reports from inside that there have been mass arrests of people. They're paranoid on several levels. One, they're extremely paranoid at the moment about spies, people reporting to the coalition their positions for airstrikes. So there are mass arrests in the city due to that, and also due to this campaign. Kataib Mosul have also been have claimed that they've killed, assassinated ISIS operatives inside the city. So yeah, a lot of arrests. Recently, ISIS put out a video of the execution of three teenagers, young men that they accused of carrying out this graffiti campaign.
And meanwhile, the Iraqi government is trying to support this resistance. They've been dropping leaflets in Mosul saying that the zero hour is coming soon. What are we expecting?
Yeah, obviously, we've got the build up at the moment for an operation in Mosul backed by coalition airstrikes. That's something that the Iraqi government have pledged to do by the end of the year. So there's a real push on now to be in position to get that offensive started. They did a huge leaflet drop recently over Mosul, telling people to stay away from ISIS positions and that the liberation is coming through. That is something that they've done in the past as well. And they say they're in contact with these groups inside, and they say that they have people reporting information and intelligence, and that they're cooperating with these small but growing resistance movements.
How big a blow to ISIS would it be if they were to lose control of Mosul?
Mosul is definitely the capital of the caliphate in Iraq. It's very symbolic and significant to them. It's where Abu Bakr Baghdadi stood and declared the caliphate from the mosque in Mosul in his first public appearance. It's very essential to that narrative of them having a caliphate. It was after Mosul fell that it really enabled ISIS to proclaim itself as a state. So losing Mosul, and I think it's almost inevitable now that they will lose Mosul. It's really going to be a huge step on the way to ISIS losing the ability to call themselves a state.
Do they have control over other large cities in Iraq? Obviously, they don't have control over the capital, Baghdad, but do they have pockets of support even there?
In Baghdad, they definitely don't have much reach at all in Baghdad these days. The security situation in Baghdad is definitely better than it was, except, they are able to carry out bombings, devastating bombings now and then in the city. They've lost Ramadi, which was one of the other big cities they controlled. They've lost Fallujah more recently. Mosul is the last major city that they control in Iraq. They do control other towns. Hawija, there's a talk of an offensive in Hawija soon, and some debate as to whether that needs to come before Mosul. But Mosul is really their last significant stronghold in Iraq.
And how big a role are U.S. forces playing in the fight against ISIS in Iraq? And how big a role might they play in the battle for Mosul?
They're playing a supportive role. Obviously, coalition airstrikes have played a huge role in all the Iraqi forces' offensives. They admit that, you know, they wouldn't have been able to retake a lot of these places without that air support. Adamant that there are no boots on the ground, but we're seeing U.S. advisors closer to the front lines. U.S. troops are moving up to Gayara now, which is south of Mosul, which is going to be a big operating logistics hub for the Mosul offensive. There is a closer collaboration, closer to the front lines with this coming Mosul offensive. And obviously, we've seen the U.S. announce more troops to be sent for it.
That's Loveday Morris, the Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. Loveday, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to an NPR exclusive on the latest efforts in the world of genetic research. A Swedish scientist is now experimenting with modifying the genes in healthy human embryos. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein learned about the experiments while on a recent tour of the scientist's lab in Stockholm. And Rob joins us now. It's good to talk with you.
Nice to be here.
So first of all, who is this scientist and what exactly is he doing?
His name is Friedrich Lahner, and he's a developmental biologist at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. And he's trying to learn more about the early stages of human development by using new genetic editing tools that just made these kinds of experiments possible.
Okay, so what exactly are these experiments then?
So he's working with two-day-old embryos that were donated by couples who went through IVF to try to have babies. And he's using this new genetic engineering technique that I mentioned to make changes in different genes that he thinks may be crucial for normal, healthy embryonic development. Now, the goal here is to try to figure out what goes wrong for certain women and makes them either incapable of getting pregnant or unable to carry pregnancies to term. Lanner hopes what he learns will lead to new ways to treat infertility and prevent miscarriages from happening and help millions of women have healthy babies. He also hopes that he'll learn things about embryonic stem cells that will help scientists turn them into treatments for lots of diseases, you know, incurable diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or diabetes.
Well, it's interesting because obviously lots of laudable reasons for this type of experimentation, but it's really controversial, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's extremely controversial. You know, it's been kind of considered off limits for decades for scientists to make any kind of changes in the genes in human eggs, sperm, or embryos. And the reason is fears that someone might try to make a baby this way. And the concern about that is that, you know, would it be safe? Would it work? Or, you know, after all, this is new technology. The scientists don't really know how to use it yet. And they could accidentally create some new disease that would then be passed down for generations and kind of, you know, mess up the human gene pool.
But in addition to those safety concerns, there are some significant moral and ethical issues as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sort of the bigger fear here is that someday this could lead to what people call designer babies. You know, that's where scientists create, you know, genetically engineered embryos to produce babies with any kind of traits that parents might want. It's, you know, it's the kind of stuff that's been, you know, kind of fodder for dystopian science fiction for decades, you know, books like Brave New World and movies like Gattaca. The worry is that we may kind of be on the cusp of that sort of thing becoming a reality. And that raises all kinds of concerns about, you know, genetically engineering the human race and even trying to create what could be perceived as genetically superior people.
So what does the scientist in Sweden, Friedrich Lahner, say about all of this?
Well, he says, look, he has no interest in anything like that. In fact, would be opposed to it. He just wants to do basic research that he hopes will lead to important new insights into basic human biology that could alleviate a lot of suffering and help a lot of people. He's only planning to study the embryos that he creates for maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks tops. And in fact, in Sweden right now, it would be illegal to try to create a baby using a genetically modified human embryo.
So that's in Sweden. But is anyone else in other parts of the world trying this sort of experiment?
Well, you know, there are scientists in China had previously already created genetically modified human embryos using defective human embryos. So it wouldn't be a surprise if scientists there tried to do similar things using healthy human embryos. And researchers in Britain have gotten government approval to do the kinds of experiments that are being now started in Sweden, and they plan to start those later this year. In the United States, scientists can't use federal funding to do any kind of research on human embryos, but they could try this using, you know, private funding or state funding. Well, we haven't heard about anything like that right now, but that's a possibility. And in the meantime, the National Academy of Sciences has been in the midst of a big international initiative to try to provide some guidance to scientists about really how far they should go, how far scientists should be allowed to go when it comes to tinkering with genes in human embryos. They're expected to issue their recommendations by the end of the year, maybe early next year.
Well, that's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thank you so much.
Oh, sure. Nice to be here.
On yesterday's program, we talked about the United Nations meeting on the alarming rise of superbugs and how the overuse of antibiotics and antibacterial agents are contributing to that rise. Well, that overuse is also hurting our microbiome. That's the collection of good microbes that live in and on our bodies. And as a new book argues, that could compromise children's health. The book is called Let Them Eat Dirt. It's written by B. Brett Finley, a professor of microbiology at the University of British Columbia, and Marie-Claire Arrieta, an assistant professor of physiology and pharmacology at the University of Calgary. Brett and Claire join us in the studio now, and let's just start with that title. You're not suggesting that children literally eat dirt, but you do say we're living in an oversanitized world, so what implication does that have?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're not suggesting you shovel bucket of dirt down a poor newborn's mouth. But the concept is there, and I think we all sort of deep down know this. And this is really a hangover we've had over the last century of cleaning up our world. You know, in the early 1900s, 30% of the kids in U.S. cities died before the age of one. Now, less than 0.1% die of infections. You have sewer systems. You get rid of the mice and the rats. You collect the garbage. You bring in clean water, clean food. You're bringing antibiotics. We have had a major success story, and kids don't die of infections anymore. So that's terrific. But in the last, under a decade or so, we now starting to realize that, well, not only are we killing all the bad microbes, we're killing the ones that actually we are starting to realize are good for us. And so this really hypervigilance to sanitation has wiped out a whole microbial generation, really. And so our kids are no longer exposed to the kids that humans have developed with. So they're just not getting the bugs that Homo sapiens evolved with. And now this has real impact on what we call Western society diseases like asthma, allergies, obesity, diabetes. These all have microbial links.
Right. So I'm really glad you said that because, of course, as you mentioned, a century ago, there were important public health reasons for wanting to reduce infections. But sort of having gone too far or having been too good at controlling pathogens is a really interesting idea. So can you tell us a little bit more about the microbial links to, I mean, let's take asthma, first of all. What are the good bacteria, good microbes that we're missing that might contribute to higher prevalence of asthma?
We recently last year showed that when babies, really, really small babies, 3-month-old babies, are missing just 4 types of bacteria, that puts them at a very high risk of developing asthma later in life.
So and what is it that the bacteria, those 4 types are doing that protect children from asthma later in life?
One of the main tasks that bacteria do for us is mature our immune system. We're born without microbes, but as soon as we're born, we get millions of them. And our immune system relies on them to complete the maturation process. And if they skip or get depleted of some microbes, the immune system becomes sloppy. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do, which is to try and distinguish friend from foe. And later, it leads to these type of diseases like asthma.
Asthma and allergies and perhaps even contributes to obesity?
Yeah, for sure. So immune diseases like inflammatory bowel disease, but also metabolic diseases like diabetes and obesity. Another thing that microbes do is that they're key decision makers on how we store or burn fat. Hmm. So it's not surprising that these are the diseases that are growing so much in society.
Right. Let's just take an ideal scenario. A healthy, you know, young child having these additional microbes in their body. I mean, in the book, you write about how they're so important. They're like almost an additional organ. Yep. In the human body. Can you tell us more about that?
So early in life, that's when your body's doing most of its developing, right? And so we now realize that, as Clara said, these microbes educate the immune system, and without these microbes, the immune system actually doesn't develop normally. And even such things as the brain, we now know that there's, you know, the gut-brain connection. We realize these microbes make molecules can affect how the brain develops, even in utero and early at birth. And there's these crazy experiments in animals that you can actually take, say, a depressed mouse, do a fecal transfer, only move the feces into a normal mouse, that mouse will become depressed just by moving the microbes.
Does some of the research indicate that the gut microbes might actually be secreting particular chemicals that are very important for mood regulation?
Yeah, they can make neurotransmitters. They can also interface with the immune system, which actually affects the neurons. And they can affect how it's called the vagus nerve that hooks the gut to the brain, how it all works. So they're really... We used to always think the brain is just talking to the gut. We now realize the gut's also talking to the brain, and that has been a real mind shift in the whole field of neurobiology.
So before we move on, I want to ask you, so if a parent or just anyone listening to this, you know, they're hearing about the gut microbiome and they're thinking, well, okay, should I be eating more yogurt? Should I go out and buy those probiotics? I mean, I feel like there's a big industry rising around, you know, around this new science. But in terms of like taking probiotics, I don't think it's necessarily been proven that that makes a positive difference. Has it?
Yeah, it hasn't. If you show up to a drugstore or to a health store by yourself and try to pick a product, it's extremely hard. One of the things that we did with the book is try to suggest to use only the products that have been shown to be beneficial. We created a link to a really, really neat chart that summarizes the products that have been tested.
So are you suggesting in the book that essentially we are keeping the environment surrounding kids today just too clean, and that they're not interacting with good microbes or even bad ones that give their immune system a good workout?
Well, there's no data to say that having diseases, infectious diseases, actually improves you. So we don't have to infect our kids. But what we are sort of pointing forward is you need a balance between the risk of exposing your kid to an infection versus the risk of exposing them just to the good microbes. For example, a kid is playing the sandbox. Well, that's good, but if there's cat feces in the cat, maybe you should avoid that. You know, the kids licking the floor in your house, that's probably okay. They're not allowed to lick the floor in the subway station. But the other thing to remember is the chance of your kids contracting polio in the playground in, you know, modern America. It's not like it was 100 years ago. So, you know, you don't have to wash your child's hands 100 times a day when they're playground. Just wash them once when you come in, you know, for dinner with soap and water, not antibacterials.
There's some pretty deeply ingrained habits that might be a little difficult to unwind. Because I was just thinking, you know, in one of my kids' school, when I drop my kid off in the mornings, I see a lot of her fellow students have like little clip-on hand sanitizers on their
everywhere.
Backpack.
They are. Yeah, for sure. These things are marketed with the illusion that they're going to make us healthy, and they're not. I mean, in the hospital, yes, you would need them. If you're out camping and you don't have a good source of water to wash yourself, yeah, you could use them, but we do not need them.
So did the FDA then take a good step when it recently banned
very
several
so.
Antibacterial yeah. chemicals that are frequently found in antibacterial soaps?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, that's because the study showed they didn't work.
I mean,
they didn't do any different than soap and water. So in terms of what you wash with, soap and water, you know, for meals, perhaps after the bathroom kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you don't need to be the hyper clean.
Right. You know, we've been talking a lot about sort of ways that we've been trying to sanitize our environment. But in the book, you also underscore that there's a very, very important thing that parents can do with their children to encourage the growth of this good microbiome. And that has to do with the food that children eat.
That's right. Microbes, they thrive pretty much on fiber. That's what they're there for. They're there to help us digest plant-derived fibers that we as mammals cannot digest. So our current diet packed with refined flours and sugars, this is not the right food for a healthy, diverse microbiome. So think about vegetables and fruits and whole grains instead of refined ones.
The other thing to remember is that white sugar, white flour type things, they're absorbed very early in the intestine, in the upper intestine. They don't reach the large intestine where all the microbes are. So in essence, even though you're eating white sugar and white fat, you're actually starving your microbes because they didn't even get there. So that's why you're encouraged to eat the harder to digest foods like fibers, like fruits, like vegetables, because that's actually feeding the microbes. Final point I want to make, which I find very scary, is that each generation we get cleaner and cleaner. Mm. Each generation we have less and less microbes. does that mean that our great-great-parents' microbes are actually an endangered species and we can't have them anymore even if they want them? So there's a lot of concern that each generation, as we clean these up, like any other endangered species, they will go extinct and we can't go back to the way we were, which is really scary, I think.
There's a frequent choice that parents have to make when they take their kids to the doctor, for example. You know, should you ask for the antibiotic when your kid has a fever or not?
What we're now realizing is, like many things, we've overused antibiotics. And it's they're antibiotics, yes, they will kill the infection-causing agents, but they kill all microbes equally well. So they will kill the good ones and the bad ones together. So there is a sort of a concerted effort to use antibiotics only when you need them. Now, if a kid has a serious bacterial infection and antibiotics will work, use them by all means. They will save that kid's life. But don't use them if they might not work. And now we just thought, what the heck? You know, it's a cold, it can't hurt kind of thing. We now realize it does hurt. And so we have to be much wiser in our use of antibiotics.
Well, finally, for parents listening right now who are really thinking, maybe I need to make some changes in how I live, what would you recommend on a daily basis? What adjustments should people be making in order to encourage a healthy microbiome?
Toss that gel hand sanitizer. It doesn't really work. Diet is huge. And if they can, to get a dog. And of course, only if they can, because you should be a responsible dog owner and not just get it to promote health. But dogs are a great vector, if you may, or vehicle of microbes. They go outside and they bring that outdoors into your home in the form of dirty paws and all of that. And that's good. In fact, that decreases the chances of children of developing allergies and asthma.
Yeah, I guess I add to that, of course, use antibiotics wisely. And then I'll finally sort of let a kid be a kid. I mean, what do kids do? Watch a kid in action. They put everything they possibly can in their mouth. Why are they doing that? Well, they're trying to figure out, oh, this is the world I live in. You know, you put a stick in your mouth, the kid probably won't get sick and say, oh, this tastes terrible and they won't do it again kind of thing. So I think this whole hyper, don't touch the world we live in has to change.
Well, B. Brett Finley is a professor of microbiology at the University of British Columbia. Marie-Claire Arrieta is an assistant professor in the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology at the University of Calgary. And their new book is Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The open enrollment season for health plans kicks off in the coming weeks, and for the 11 million Americans using Affordable Care Act exchanges, they can expect price increases and less competition. CNBC's Bertha Coombs joins us to look at that. She's in New York at the NASDAQ Stock Exchange. And Bertha, what's going to happen now with the Affordable Care Act and people who have their health insurance through these exchanges?
Well, you know, a lot of folks I talk to say this is going to be a very important year for the Affordable Care Act exchanges. You know, over the last year or so, we have seen insurers start to say, hey, we are just losing too much money here and we can't keep going. The large insurers are the ones that have gotten all the headlines for pulling out. United Health was the first one. But the ones that are really getting impacted are the local insurers, the Blue Cross, Blue Shield in every state. Part of the issue is political because they were supposed to get reinsurance rebates, if you will. They didn't come in as strong as many had expected. Some of them have actually gone out of business. So that's limiting the choice. And often what happens is all of a sudden the insurers that are left on the exchange, let's take Arizona, for example. I was recently reporting on the huge upheaval that we've seen there when Aetna decided it was not going to participate in that state and several others next year. All of a sudden, if you're the last insurer standing in a state, you really have to think about what your rates are going to be, because suddenly you're going to get a big influx of costly patients.
And what about the people who are not on the exchanges? Do they feel that increase as well?
They do. They feel it more so. Health Secretary Sylvia Burwell notes that most of the people in the exchange, you know, 80-85% of them get some sort of subsidy in the form of a tax credit. For folks who do not qualify for those premiums, folks, individuals who are making more than $45,000 a year and have to pay the full freight, they're likely to see some increases as well.
And I'm sure that if somebody from the Obama administration was listening to this and saying, well, yes, there are problems, they would also point to the fact that I think the census data that just came out the other day found that a record low number of people are actually uninsured in this country at this point.
That is the other side. I mean, two-thirds of folks next year will continue to see competition. They'll have a choice of between three or more insurers, according to Kaiser Family Foundation research. But the fact is, it's still a difficult market. And if insurers can't continue to lose money indefinitely. So yes, people are getting insured, but the market itself needs a lot of help. And I think people who are on both sides of the aisle will say that. The big problem is whether you'll get some sort of unanimity on how to fix it. You know, the other side of having such high enrollment in insurance is that we are spending a lot more on healthcare. And as healthcare prices continue to increase, that just continues to take away more money from people's pockets that they can spend on other things.
Bertha Coombs of CNBC joining us from New York. Bertha, thanks so much.
Great talking to you, Jeremy. My pleasure.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
Eric J. Lawrence is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. He joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's get to some of the music that you wanted us to hear this week. This is from the British folk musician Ian A. Anderson. This is called Paint It Black.
I see that red door and I want to paint it black. No colors anymore, I want to turn them black. I see those girls go by dressed in their summer clothes. I have to turn my head until the darkness goes. I see that line of cars and they're all painted black. With flowers for my love who never will come back. See people down there.
First of all, I have to say, how about that R roll on Red Door?
Exactly, yeah.
But this is a Rolling Stones cover.
Yes, it's people might not even pick up on that right away. It's so radically different in its tone. Ian A. Anderson, this is not the Jethro Tull guy, by the way, a contemporary of his. But Ian A. Anderson started recording in the late 60s and doing sort of a more traditional British country blues sort of idiom. But then a few years later, in the early 70s, he started experimenting a little bit and created a sound which we now sort of retroactively call acid folk. And this is a track that he recorded on one of those albums where he was doing that style from 1972 album called Singer Sleeps On As Blaze Rages. It just proves to me that the malleability and flexibility of pop music to be able to withstand sometimes radical reinterpretations, and much in the same way that we can take a great Shakespeare play and put it in a different setting or a different geography and still glean some meaning out of it.
All right, well, let's get to the next one you wanted us to hear. This is the UK-based group Cat's Eyes. Here is Be Careful Where You Park Your Car.
Be careful where you park your car. There's no telling what she might do, 'cause she never had the chance to hurt you too. And if you're asking why,
kind of a 60s or 70s quality to that.
For sure. It has that kind of classic girl group sound of the late 60s with like the Shirelles or the Shangri-Las. And in fact, that sort of sound was what brought the two main participants of the band together, coming from sort of different worlds. It is Faris Badwan, who's a member of the band The Horrors, and then classically trained soprano Rachel Zafira is the vocalist on that. And they came together and put together this project called Cat's Eyes. They've released a couple of albums. They contributed some music to the soundtrack of the film The Duke of Burgundy last year. But this is from their new album called Treasure House. And I think this song most closely exemplifies their appreciation of that kind of classic girl group sound, with a little bit of a modern edge to it, you know, giving a little more danger, slashing tires, the threat of slashing tires in there somehow.
And what drew you to it?
You know, it's just so evocative. I'm always fascinated by music that seems timeless, or rather seems out of time, perhaps. This is a brand new artist, but they're sort of definitely evoking this sound of 40 plus years ago. And, you know, pop music is 100 years old, so there's lots of different directions to go. And I like it when you can kind of put something that combines different eras together in one.
Well, let's get to the next one. This one is from Fort Wayne, Indiana, the singer-songwriter who calls himself Slow Dakota. This is the Lilac Bush.
One day I came close to giving up my goals. I put my chin inside the mouth of
a very interesting sound. And by the way, people are going to love this. He describes himself on Facebook as Baroque pop.
Yes. Well, that is a pretty
perfect.
Pretty
works perfectly, doesn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm a Hoosier by birth, so it's always great to be able to shout out some Hoosier musicians.
Yeah.
And this, his real name is PJ Sauerteig, something like that. Which probably explains why he goes under a little more easy moniker, such as Slow Dakota. But he's released a number of records, and he does use this sort of interesting sound that still maintains that kind of contemporary, introspective singer-songwriter mode of somebody like a Sufjan Stevens, but sort of throws it with this, yeah, Renaissance, Elizabethan sort of sound. It almost makes it sound like there should be sackbuts and viola da gambas there in the backdrop playing the music. It reminds me a bit, too, of the Dead Can Dance, the band Dead Can Dance, that uses sort of elements of world music to kind of create this really kind of mysterious, evocative sound.
All right, let's get to the next one. This is the L.A. artist Morgan Delt with Some Sunsick Day. Good theme for a song on the week when summer officially ends. I know that you don't really care about that in Los Angeles, but we do in the rest of the country right now.
I will declare this is probably my favorite song of the summer from a record that came out earlier this summer called Phase Zero. And yeah, he's very much working in kind of this psychedelic sound, a little bit of the Laurel Canyon tradition that's very popular in Southern California, sort of evoking the sun and the beach and sort of these vistas, maybe even the proximity to Joshua Tree giving off that whiffs of patchouli attached to it as well. And musically, it sounds to me like a cross between the kind of modern sounds of Kurt Vile, but with the production techniques of a band like Tame Impala. It's just really a great combination. And his voice is so great, just barely above a whisper, but it's reverbed all heck and just kind of seems to go endlessly.
And what should we know about Morgan Delt?
You know, local artist. He's had a couple of records out. This is actually his debut for the Sub Pop record label. So he's getting a little more attention, but he's definitely part of this. I would describe it as a scene that's going on in Los Angeles at the moment to sort of really sort of celebrate psychedelic music.
All right, before we let you go, Eric, we've got time for one more. This is from the Welsh group Soft Hearted Scientist. This is called Shiver Me Timbers.
Been trying hard to keep this vessel on course. The demon hand steer it to hostile shores. Monsters always rise up from the deep. Thought they were dead, but they were only asleep. Shiver the timbers, the ship's going down, 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 down. Shiver the timbers, the ship's going down. Shiver the timbers, the ship's going down.
Shiver me timbers, this ship's going down. Music with, it sounds like a little bit of a sense of humor.
Yeah, I think so. The Welsh have a long-standing tradition of mysticism in their arts, both the literature and music. And in previous records, this is actually their seventh album called Golden Omen. His previous records have lots of references to monsters and ghosts and that kind of a thing, but it's all done in a very jaunty style, following sort of another British tradition of this sort of folksy pastoral power pop that is maybe reminiscent of bands like XTC or Belle and Sebastian.
Well, and I hate to compare things to the Beatles, because you can compare almost anything to the Beatles in some way or another, and it's probably not fair to the Beatles to do that, but it does remind me of a song like, you know, Yellow Submarine, even just the subject matter.
That's right, exactly. No, I mean, really, I think they're really... I'm surprised there aren't as many songs called Shiver Me Timbers. It just sort of has that nice ring to it. But yes, I sort of hum that line, Shiver Me Timbers, the ship's going down, 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 as I walk the streets of L.A. for the past several months.
And people are like, what's with this guy? Eric J. Lawrence, DJ at KCRW, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you can go to our Spotify playlist to hear all of our DJ session picks. We're NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
In Charlotte, North Carolina, a state of emergency was declared after two nights of violent protest following the police killing of a black man. And today, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney said he will not release video of the shooting. He plans to show it to the family of the 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott. Putney said the video does not definitively show Scott pointing a gun. Meanwhile, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton weighed in yesterday on the police killings of African Americans. Both decried recent shootings in Tulsa and Charlotte. So let's listen to extended excerpts from both candidates. Here's Donald Trump at the New Spirit Revival Center in Cleveland Heights, Ohio.
Well, as you know, I'm a tremendous believer in the police and law enforcement because we need that for ourselves. We need it. And I've really gotten the endorsement from so many different groups, and they're great people. They're great people. Now, great people, you always have problems. You have somebody in there that either makes a mistake, that's bad, or that chokes. I must tell you, I watched the shooting in particular in Tulsa, and that man was hands up. That man went to the car, hands up, put his hand on the car. I mean, to me, it looked like he did everything you're supposed to do. And he looked like a really good man. And maybe I'm a little clouded because I saw his family talking about him after the fact. So you get a little bit, you know, different image maybe. But to me, he looked like a, you know, somebody that was doing what they were asking him to do. And this young officer, I don't know what she was thinking. I don't know what she was thinking, but I'm very, very troubled by that. I'm very, very troubled by that. And we have to be very careful. So, I mean, these things are terrible. That was, in my opinion, that was a terrible situation. And we've seen others. And the police are aware of that, too. By the way, the police are troubled by it, too. They look at it. Now, did she get scared? Was she choking? What happened? But maybe people like that, people that choke, people that do that, maybe they can't be doing what they're doing. Okay? They can't be doing what they're doing. So, yeah.
Donald J. Trump, man of the people.
Yeah. Thank you. So we all respect our police greatly, and they will just have to get better and better and better. Thank you.
That's Donald Trump speaking yesterday in Ohio. Hours after making those remarks, Trump endorsed broader use of stop and frisk, the controversial policy that allows police to search anyone they deem suspicious. He said the practice worked incredibly well in New York. In 2013, though, a New York federal judge struck down the tactic, calling it discriminatory against people of color and unconstitutional. Well, today, Trump said he was referring to using stop and frisk specifically in Chicago, not nationwide. Now, on to Hillary Clinton. Yesterday, she was at the Frontline Outreach Center in Orlando, Florida.
I'm here today to talk about how to make our economy work for everyone. But first, I need to say something about two very upsetting incidents that took place over the past few days. First, an unarmed man named Terrence Crutcher was shot and killed by a police officer in Tulsa. Then a man named Keith Lamont Scott was shot and killed by a police officer in Charlotte. I'm sending condolences and prayers to their families. I know a lot of you are as well. There is still much we don't know about what happened in both incidents, but we do know that we have two more names to add to a list of African Americans killed by police officers in these encounters. It's unbearable, and it needs to become intolerable. We also saw the targeting of police officers in Philadelphia last week. And last night in Charlotte, 12 officers were injured in demonstrations following Keith Lamont Scott's death. Every day, police officers across our country are serving with extraordinary courage, honor, and skill. We saw that again this weekend in New York and New Jersey and Minnesota. Our police handled those terrorist attacks exactly right, and they likely saved a lot of lives. I've spoken to many police chiefs and other law enforcement leaders who are as deeply concerned as I am and deeply committed as I am to reform. Why? Because they know it is essential for the safety of our communities and our officers. We are safer when communities respect the police and police respect communities.
That's Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.